welcome to Wizard Studies.
Join us as we peruse all things Potter.
Hello, and welcome to Wizard Studies. I'm Katie.
And I'm Audrey. And today we are going to be talking about the classic favorite, Gryffindor House.
So to start this episode off, I was just going to pose a question to you, Audrey. When you were reading through the books for the first time, did you picture yourself in Gryffindor like the trio, or did you never feel like that was quite right for you?
I think I definitely pictured myself being friends with the trio in Gryffindor, but I don't think I ever consciously was thinking about that wasn't right for me, because at the time I was reading this, I feel like you don't really know what house you're going to be in. But since then, I've always felt like once I started thinking more about my house, I always identified way more with Ravenclaw than Gryffindor. But I am, when I take the percentages test, I do end up being, my next highest house is Gryffindor. What about you?
Kind of the same. I think when I read through the series, I always pictured myself being friends with the trio, kind of like you said, but Gryffindor never felt right to me. I always knew I wasn't a Gryffindor. When I was young, I never knew what house I was. Like, I didn't immediately latch on to Hufflepuff, but then when I got sorted, I was really hoping to get Hufflepuff, and I did, and that's just, we've been tight ever since. I love being a Hufflepuff, but kind of the same as you, I always get Gryffindor as my second highest percentage house, which I was kind of shocked about when I took the quiz. I always thought that Ravenclaw would end up being my second highest, just because, I don't know, this is going to sound super shallow, but I was kind of young when I was doing this anyways. I always just really liked school. I was good at school. I enjoyed going to school, so I just always thought Ravenclaw would end up being my second, because I never really pictured myself fitting into Gryffindor that much, but that's why it's my second house, I guess.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think my Gryffindor qualities aren't, like, super obvious, but I think it's right as my second house. I like Hufflepuff, but I don't really feel that it's that strong in me. And then, because when I take the percentage quizzes, I always get, like, 2% Hufflepuff and 2% Slytherin. All right, so let's start out talking about some traits of Gryffindors. So we hear a lot of quotes throughout the book about what a Gryffindor is and their personality traits. So I think the first things we start to hear are from the Sorting Hat, of course. It says, "You might belong in Gryffindor, where dwell the brave at heart. Their daring nerve and chivalry set Gryffindors apart." So right from the start, we're hearing about the bravery of Gryffindors. Then again, we hear, "By Gryffindor, the bravest were prized far beyond the rest." And this quote, I really like the next one, which is from Half-Blood Prince. And I don't remember who says it. Do you remember who says this one?
The yes, when you were telling us.
Yeah.
I think that's Hermione.
That's what it's either Hermione or Ron, right?
I think it's Hermione. For some reason, I picture Hermione saying that quote.
All right, so this quote is, "Yes, when you were telling us what it's like to face Voldemort, you said it wasn't just memorizing a bunch of spells. You said it was just you and your brains and your guts. Well, wasn't that what Snape was saying? That it really comes down to being brave and quick thinking." Which is exactly how Harry survived Voldemort so many times. And then this next quote is from Hermione in Sorcerer's Stone. She says, "Books and cleverness, there are more important things, friendship and bravery, and oh, Harry, be careful." It's a classic Hermione quote. I take a little issue with it, because she's kind of bashing Ravenclaw there with the books and cleverness thing. But I like the sentiment, and it's one of those instances where you see that Hermione is a true Gryffindor, and it's so early on, too.
Yeah, I think that's actually one of the first times where you see Hermione truly show Gryffindor qualities. I think the whole first book, at least when I go back and read it, if I could put myself in the same mind as if I was reading it for the first time, I'd probably be wondering, like, why is Hermione in Gryffindor? She seems so much more like a Ravenclaw, and she does have a lot of Ravenclaw traits, but I think she is truly a Gryffindor at heart, and that quote is something that shows that.
I agree. And then the last quote here is classic Dumbledore quote that he says, I believe it's at the end of The Sorcerer's Stone when Neville is, he's rewarding Neville his house points, which end up giving Gryffindor the house cup. And he says, it takes a great deal of bravery to stand up to our enemies, but just as much to stand up to our friends. And I feel like that's a really classic quote that gets quoted a lot. And I also like this quote because it's a little shout out to why Neville is a Gryffindor too. He's another character that's in Gryffindor that everybody says, no, he doesn't belong there, but he really comes into his own, and we should have known from the beginning that he was just as brave as everyone else in Gryffindor.
Yeah, going off on a little tangent right now, you talking about house points just made me think about something. Because when you mentioned that, I was thinking, why doesn't Ravenclaw or Hufflepuff ever enter into the picture in the house race? And I guess a part of that is plot. But if you think about it more, I think that Gryffindor and Slytherin have house traits that set them up better to be house champions. I think that they, in theory, care more about the house cup, like Slytherin's ambition, wanting to win, Gryffindor's braveness and boldness and kind of taking credit for what they do, where I think Hufflepuff, in theory, should be the winners every year because we follow the rules so we don't get points taken away from us. But I also don't think we get many points because we don't stand out. We don't boast about our accomplishments. We just do it and, like, fly under the cover.
And theoretically, Ravenclaw should be getting a lot of points because if we are the most intelligent, then they should be getting a ton of points in class. So, yeah, I think it is a plot device. But I get what you're saying. Like, Slytherin and Gryffindor seem like they would be the two types of personality traits that would care the most about the house. Although, I don't, the house cup, but, like, I'm really competitive, so I would want to win the house cup.
Yeah, that's true. I just feel like Ravenclaw and Hufflepuff start out with a disadvantage because, I don't know, I just don't think that that, especially with Hufflepuff coming from a little bit selfishly knowing a little bit more about my house, I just don't think that too many Hufflepuffs would really care about the house cup. I'm competitive, but I also don't know if I'd go out of my way sometimes like Harry and Ron and Hermione do, or I don't think that we would ever be recognized because nobody cares about us, but that's a whole nother story.
What is the quote from Puffs the Play? Third or nothing?
Yeah, something like that. Oh, man. But yeah, so moving on from Gryffindor's traits, I'm going to talk a little bit about their weaknesses. I definitely didn't list out all of them here, but I kind of just picked out some big ones. So they're pretty brash and they act without thinking, which I think we see a lot, especially with Harry throughout the series. And then connected with that, they can have a little bit of a hero complex. Again, super displayed in Harry. And I think one instance where Harry has a hero complex and is brash and acts without thinking is when, in the Order of the Phoenix, he decides to go to the Ministry to save Sirius, even though Hermione is telling him the whole time, what if Voldemort's just using this as a decoy to get you to the Ministry? And he just does it because he has to save Sirius. He doesn't think about it. He doesn't think about the repercussions. He just goes because that's how his mind and his brain is wired. And then another example of having a little bit of a hero complex, I think, is in Hermione wanting to save the house elves all the time. She has this sense of duty to help people, and I think that her hero-ness comes out a lot in how she tries to save the house elves and free them, which I think is an example that sometimes is forgotten about and doesn't always get the respect and hype that it deserves.
Yeah, it's definitely a less obvious example because Hermione's not really risking her life or fighting scary creatures and people. But it's definitely a show of her bravery and just being brave enough to stand up when everyone's ridiculing her for it is definitely a good example of that.
Yeah, and I think that goes along with the hero complex too. Just, I feel like Gryffindors always have this sense of they have something to prove. They always need to be doing something, and I think that comes out a lot of times in wanting to help people and their hero complex that they do have.
Right, it's kind of like a sense of duty.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, so Godric Gryffindor, the founder of Gryffindor House. Shocker there on the namesake. He was born...
Wait, what do you think would happen if the founders just had the worst names ever? Like, what if their last names were Allen and Olsen?
Just, like, really like, generic names.
Yeah, I get that that makes no sense because JK wouldn't have written a lame name to be a house, but just think about it. Like, if I had a house named after me, that'd be so terrible. My name is not interesting. It's actually kind of bad.
Yeah, that'd be funny. Also, like, what if one founder didn't have the alliteration? So, yeah. Like, what if Godric's name was really, like, Robert?
Ralph.
Ralph. And so he just changed his name to Godric so that he could go down in history with the rest of them.
No, to be honest, if I ever had to name something after me, I would probably change my name or, like, do my middle name or something. Sorry, Dad.
All right. So, Godric Gryffindor, born in the medieval era. He's from Wild Moor, as we learn in the Sorting Hat song. And he lived in Godric's Hollow. Whoa, another thing named after
him. What
was
it named before?
It was named before?
No, what was it named before?
Oh, I don't know. Do you think it just didn't
have
a name? Do
you think he, like, colonized it?
Godric Gryffindor the colonizer.
Yeah. I mean, he's white.
Yikes. Yeah, I don't know. But that's kind of badass that he gets a neighborhood named after his first name and a house named after his last name. He is all throughout history. All right, so he was known as the most accomplished duelist of his time, which kind of lines up with what we know about Gryffindors being prone to some fights. He was buds with Salazar Slytherin until he wasn't. They had a big falling out, which... we do learn throughout the entire series. And, of course, the Sorting Hat was his, which is pretty cool. And then, also, one of his prized possessions was the Sword of Gryffindor.
Yes, that's what we're going to be talking about next. And I apologize in advance. I did a deep dive on Pottermore and came up with a long backstory for the Sword of Gryffindor, so I'm probably going to be talking for a while. But... So, most of this information comes from Pottermore and the fact file on the Sword of Gryffindor. So, let's start out pretty basically with its magical properties. So, it on Pottermore it says it contains properties only goblin main armor possesses and will take on the power of substances it touches, which, as we know, becomes very important during the hunt for Horcruxes because it's imbued with basilisk venom, which then can be used to destroy Horcruxes. The purpose is a powerful weapon that has been presenting itself to Gryffindors in times of need for centuries. So that kind of made me wonder how many other Gryffindors it's presented itself to. Who are they? What were they doing? I mean, there's already a lot of information on Pottermore about the Sword of Gryffindor, but I want more still. So who first owned it? And this is a matter of some dispute between wizards and goblins, which... also becomes important in Book 7 and the Hunt for Horcruxes because Griphook believes that the sword is rightfully his and that causes him to want the sword from the trio, but the trio doesn't want to give it up, and it's a big plot point in that book as well.
Yeah, I think that's something super interesting about all goblin-made things. I think Bill is the one that tells us this in Deathly Hallows, that they believe that when something is made for wizards... it is made just for that specific wizard and shouldn't be passed down, which is, like, a super human thing to do. We pass down all our possessions, so Godric's sword gets passed down to all Gryffindors that ever need it. And I think this example came up when Fleur had Auntie Muriel's, like, wedding tiara that was goblin-made, and Griphook was, like, eyeing it and thought that it belonged to goblins, which is just an interesting difference between... the two species.
Yeah, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about the ownership when I get to the writing that JK has on the sword. And so then the last part of the fact file is when it was made, and it was forged 1,000 years ago by Ragnarok the First, King of the Goblins. So then moving on to JK's writing on it. So it gives a lot of history on the sword and talks mainly about the ownership and how that was disputed. So Ragnarok finished the sword, but he loved it so much that he didn't want to give it up. And so he pretended that Godric Gryffindor had stolen the sword from him when he had actually given it to Godric, or Godric had taken it because he bought it. And so Ragnuk sends a group of goblins after Godric to take it back from him. In doing this, when the goblins get there, Godric defends himself, but he doesn't kill any of the goblins. He just sends them back, bewitched, to deliver the threat to Ragnuk that if he ever tried to steal a sword from Gryffindor again, Gryffindor would unsheath the sword against them all. So he basically threatens that if Ragnuk tries to steal a sword again, he's going to go batshit crazy and kill them all. And then Ragnuk takes the threat seriously, which I think was wise because I would have as well.
Yeah, I'd be scared of Gryffindor.
And basically is just bitter his entire life about this. He gives the sword up to Gryffindor because he never tries to take it back, but he never fully gives it up in his mind. He always believed that it was rightfully his, and so he's bitter about this and takes that to his grave, basically. And that's how the myth started, that Gryffindor stole the sword from the goblins and that it's rightfully the goblins. So then later on the writing, it addresses kind of a big question, which I feel like Potter fans have had since the Chamber of Secrets, and this is, why does a wizard need a sword? We have wands. Why do we need a sword? A wand is so much more useful, and frankly, it's better than a sword. And so JK does address this in the writing. She says, there was a time where wizards and muggles lived together, and wizards would need to be able to defend themselves from muggles without exposing themselves as wizards. And so they used swords for this instead of wands. They would use wands as well, but swords kind of to cover up their magic. And during that time, when they would fight, it was seen very unsporting of a wizard to defeat a muggle with a wand, which I think is pretty fair. That duel would be really unfair between a muggle and a wizard if the wizard could use his wand.
It's kind of funny, though. They're not allowed to use their wands, but they're allowed to use these swords, goblin-made swords, which are super powerful, like, so much better than a normal sword. So it's still not really a fair fight.
Yeah, true. They just keep up. They want to keep a good look. They don't want to expose themselves. And then later on the writing, JK draws a comparison between the Sword of Gryffindor and Excalibur, which I think is really interesting because I had never thought about this before, but it fits pretty well. So one of the big comparisons she draws to it is that Harry and Ron in the seventh book, when Ron rescues Harry from the lake when he dove in to get the sword, this actually pretty much is a good mirror for how King Arthur in the legends actually got the sword, because it was given to him by the Lady of the Lake, and then the sword was returned to the lake when Arthur died. So that's just a little a hint to how it could be similar to the Excalibur. So then I'm going to talk a little bit about what the sword actually looks like. So there is a quote. I'm just going to read this pretty long quote from the writing. So it says, "He even had a special sword created for him by Ragnuk I, the finest of the goblin silversmiths. The sword was gleaming silver with rubies the size of eggs. The sword was so beautiful that Ragnuk tried to take it back." And then it goes back to how he accused Godric of stealing it. So it's silver and has rubies the size of eggs, and then it also had Gryffindor's name engraved in the hilt. So that just is, I think the movie does a pretty good job of actually picturing this. It looks pretty good, I think. Pretty good replica. And then, so that's kind of the end of my spiel about the history of the Sword of Gryffindor.
Yeah, going back to the replica, did we see that at the Warner Brothers Studio Tours? I don't know that it was on display.
I don't know if we saw it anywhere. It might have just been hidden in that really big room, though.
Yeah, I wonder if it's...
I'm trying to remember. Did we see any of the Horcruxes either? I can't remember. There's so much stuff. I don't think so.
We saw the Porky.
Yeah.
I don't think we saw any of the Horcruxes, which is kind of weird because we went during the, like, Dark Arts,
yeah.
Exhibit. So maybe they're just not on display. I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe they're somewhere else, or maybe they keep it for special events.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure about that, though. So I'm going to move on to the kind of significance of the sword to this in the series and when it appears. So the first time we see it is when it appears to Harry in the Chamber of Secrets in his time of need, when he needs to defeat the Basilisk. As I previously mentioned, this scene is really important as we get on to Book 7, because this is when it's imbued with the Basilisk venom and gains the ability to destroy the Horcruxes. And eventually lets Harry defeat Lord Voldemort. So I think that's so interesting that a scene in Book 2 becomes so crucially important to the defeat of Voldemort in Book 7. So just proves that J.K. knew what she was doing the whole time and knows what she's doing in the Fantastic Beasts series. So just trust her, people.
She knows
what she's doing. And Joe, we trust. And then in Half-Blood Prince, when Snape is helping to cure Dumbledore after he put Marvolo's ring on, it's stated that the sword is on the desk next to the cracked ring. And we see this in the memories in Deathly Hallows, so it's not really a hint of what's to come when they use the sword to defeat Horcruxes, because we already know this by the time that we see this memory, but it's a little bit of an Easter egg because it did happen before we know. So when we see that, we're like, ah, yes.
Yes.
Yes, we know what Dumbledore was doing with the sword then. And then in the beginning of Deathly Hallows, Scrimgeour states that Dumbledore left the sword for Harry in his will, but he refuses to give it to Harry because he said it was never Dumbledore's to give away, that it's a property of the school or it's property of Gryffindor and belongs to all Gryffindors. And so Dumbledore, actually being the sneaky bitch he is, he anticipated this and leaves a fake sword in the headmaster's office, but he still put it in his will so that Harry knew that something was up. There was a reason that Dumbledore gave each of them the gifts that he did, and so he can kind of guess that there was a reason that he would have left Harry the sword. And so then he gives the real one to Snape to give to Harry later on. So it's kind of this big convoluted plan, but it ends up working. And then, as I kind of mentioned earlier, Snape leads Harry into the Forest of Dean to the lake with his Patronus, the doe, which he believes is a stag at that point. And then later on, Harry's like, well, I'm stupid. Stags have horns or antlers. Wow, I'm stupid. And he places it at the bottom of the frozen lake because you must be completing an act of daring to get the sword, and then Harry jumps in, but the Horcrux senses it, that it's near something that can destroy it, and so it fights back. So Ron must jump in and save Harry and get the sword and ultimately defeat the necklace.
I think this little chain of events is really interesting because we have Snape, who is a Slytherin and has serious beef with Gryffindor from his time at Hogwarts and during his time as a professor there. And he is the one who presents or, like, brings the Sword of Gryffindor back to Harry, which I think is really interesting. It makes me question the sword. It wouldn't just present itself to Harry, because he wasn't in like a time of deep crisis or something. But it's, like, less obvious danger, but he's still in danger, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting to think about, that Snape is ultimately the one who gets Harry the Sword of Gryffindor when Snape is himself a Slytherin.
Right.
And so then continuing on that chain of events, when the trio is captured by the Snatchers and brought to Malfoy Manor, they have the sword with them. And that leads Bellatrix to seeing the sword, and she freaks out and flies into a rage. She tortures Hermione about where they got the sword, because she is under the impression that the Sword of Gryffindor is in her vault, given to her by Lord Voldemort, but that one's actually the fake one. The real one is the one with Harry. Are you following along with me?
Two swords.
Yeah. And so then her rage is what eventually tips Harry off into believing that a Horcrux could be in the Lestrange vault, because he realizes that Voldemort trusts Bellatrix, and he had given a Horcrux to the Malfoys previously, so why wouldn't he have given a Horcrux to the Lestranges? And he also goes on to say something about how Gringotts is kind of the symbol of ultimate belonging in the wizarding world, and so Tom Riddle or Voldemort would have really wanted to have a vault at Gringotts. And then Griphook agrees to break into Gringotts with the trio to retrieve the Horcrux that they believe is in the Lestrange vault and ends up being Hufflepuff's cup. But he agrees to do this only in exchange for the Sword of Gryffindor because, like I kind of mentioned earlier, he believes that it belongs to the goblins. He believes that he is a rightful owner of the Sword of Gryffindor. And then Harry agrees to this, despite what Hermione and Bill tell him and warn him. He agrees to it, but he never intended to give Griphook the sword. He intended to use it and maybe then give it to Griphook. It's never really quite clear what the ultimate plan was. It was just kind of hold on to it, keep it because we need it. Don't let Griphook get it. And then the last appearance of the sword in this series is when Neville pulls it out of the sorting hat at the Battle of Hogwarts and defeats Nagini, the last Horcrux, making it possible for Voldemort to be killed. And I don't believe that Neville really knew what he was doing. I do remember that Harry, as he's walking to sacrifice himself, he tells Neville, kill the snake. If you do anything, kill the snake. The snake needs to be killed. Kind of hints at that. But I don't believe that Neville has any other inkling about what he could be doing when he does this. And I hope that Harry tells him so that he realizes how important he was to the ultimate defeat of Voldemort.
I think along the lines of Horcruxes, I think it's interesting. So we know that Voldemort may have been intending to make 4 Horcruxes from each, like item from each of the founders. And mm-hmm. I wonder if he ever tried to or thought about the Sword of Gryffindor as a potential Horcrux. Is there mention of that?
I think Dumbledore believes so, and one of the reasons he believes that is because when Tom Riddle comes back to get a job at Hogwarts, right, to become a teacher, Dumbledore thinks that he might have been doing that to get closer to some of the founder's items,
right,
and hopefully use the Sword of Gryffindor, which I don't know how he would plan on doing that if this maybe, because I guess Dumbledore was headmaster at the time he goes to ask for a job because he's the one, he asked Dumbledore for it. So if it's in the headmaster's office, why would he think that he would be able to take it?
Because he's arrogant.
Maybe create a fake sword. It worked.
Yeah. All right, so getting back to just Gryffindor House in general.
Not so much the sword anymore.
The ghost of Gryffindor House is Nearly Headless Nick, who we see multiple times throughout the series. So his Pottermore fact file, his full name is Sir Nicholas de Mimsey Porpington, which that's always...
I love that.
That's always a trivia question, I feel like.
Oh, yeah. What is Nearly Headless Nick's first name? Because I feel like a lot of people don't know that.
I feel like it only gets said a couple times.
Yeah. Yeah, but it just is such a great name. It's like Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore.
Yeah.
I feel like that's normally a trivia question. They're just names that you don't forget. If you know them, you know them.
Right. All right, so obviously Nick's house is Gryffindor, or was Gryffindor. Is what? I think is.
Is.
His skills include providing directions around Hogwarts Castle, which, yeah, he's a pretty nice ghost. I think that fits. And his hobbies are reenacting his botched beheading. Yeah.
Amazing.
His death was on the 31st of October, 1492.
Columbus sailed the ocean blue.
I was just thinking that. His cause of death was being incompletely beheaded after he was hit 45 times in the neck with a blunt axe. Which we learn all this during the Chamber of Secrets death day party scene.
I think that Nearly Headless Nick is a really good house ghost. I think probably one of the best, maybe barring the Frat Friar, shout out. Because the Bloody Baron seems like not super helpful. Whereas I think Nick takes on the duty of being a house ghost, like, with a lot of pride. He loves doing it. He loves showing first years around the castle, giving directions, helping out at Gryffindor if he can. And I don't know if all the house ghosts have that mindset, because then I think we learn about the Grey Lady, Helena Ravenclaw, I think in the seventh book it is mentioned that she will help out Ravenclaws, but doesn't really talk to anybody outside of her house, and very few people she actually talks to. So I don't picture her being a super, super helpful ghost either.
Yeah, it's, I don't.
What's that word? When, like, you only get a job because of your parents or, like, your family. It's nepotism.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, even though I'm a Ravenclaw, I might be a little disappointed with my house ghost. But I would like to think that after the Battle of Hogwarts, once Harry has destroyed the diadem, maybe she'll, like, come around and...
I could see that, yeah.
Yeah. All right, so back to Nearly Headless Nick. Well, when he was Sir Nicholas, he was a part of the royal court for Henry VII. He was then executed for a magical mishap with Lady Grieve. I think I'm pronouncing that right. Yeah, G-R-I-E-V-E. Grieve. He tried to straighten her teeth, but left her with a tusk. This kind of reminds me, maybe he was not as good of a wizard as Hermione when she shrinks her own teeth. So he really wants to become a part of the Headless Hunt, and they never let him because he wasn't fully beheaded. He's a big part of Harry's life in the books, and he always is helping him out. So in Chamber of Secrets, Nick helps Harry escape punishment from Filch after Harry tracks Mud into the castle after Quidditch practice. And then subsequently, he invites Harry to his death day party, which Harry does not want to attend. Then he was petrified, also in Chamber of Secrets, and was moved to the hospital wing. And it's really funny because they used a fan to blow him over there. I feel like they could have just used magic somehow.
Yeah. Could they have not just produced wind from their wand?
Right.
Seems... Could they levitate a fan? It seems... Why do they even have fans? Anyways.
Yeah, they don't have electricity. Yeah.
So it has to be
a magical fan. Oh, do they have like a hand fan?
No, they didn't hand fan this man all the way to the... There's no way. They probably levitated. They probably like made something spin to create a fan.
Okay, that makes sense.
Either way, it's funny. I love that. I love that visual of him just going off the rails and people like, no, 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 turn, turn, turn. I think that'd be funny.
All right, so then in Order of the Phoenix, after Sirius dies, Harry goes to Sir Nick when he has questions about death. And I think this is when we get the explanation of ghosts can choose to come back or not. Mm-hmm. And then he brags about being Harry's friends to all the other ghosts in Half-Blood Prince, because now Harry's the chosen one. And it's kind of cute. I mean, he is really using Harry's status there, but it's kind of cute. He deserves it. He's been helpful.
Yeah, I think it's really cute. And also going back to the Order of the Phoenix example, I think that that moment is super poignant in Harry's relationship with death and his grieving process with Sirius. I think Nick really helps him with that because he explains to him kind of to the best of his ability what happens when somebody dies. And we get the first kind of explanation because I feel like up to this point, a lot of readers are probably thinking, why doesn't everybody come back as ghosts? And I think Nick gives a really good explanation to why people don't want to come back as ghosts. It separates them from people that they've known that have moved on. It basically prevents them from ever moving on. They never get to eat again, which I think Nick always mentions during the feast. Oh, everything smells so good. I think it really demystifies what being a ghost is and makes it not as appealing. And I think that's really important for Harry through grieving processes because he's able to understand why Sirius left him alone, basically.
Right.
And I think he does understand that and is able to move on because of that.
Yeah, he gets a little bit of closure, even though it was really hard with Sirius's death because, of course, like, he falls through the veil and there's no body. So as much closure as he could have gotten, I feel like Nick provides that for him.
Yeah.
And then the last instance really with Nick in the series is when he helps Harry find the Grey Lady in the Deathly Hallows during the Battle of Hogwarts. I think Harry just stops and asks him who the ghost of Ravenclaw House is, and Nick's like, oh, it's the Grey Lady, but if you need a ghost to help you, and Harry's just like running away already.
I think Nick is a really underrated character. I think he really, when you go back and read the books, you forget how many times he helps Harry out, I think. And I think that relationship is really undermined in the movie, like a lot of them. And I understand why. He doesn't have any super pivotal points in the movie. Everything he does can either be taken out or given to somebody else. Because do we even see him in the movies after Chamber of Secrets? And he's petrified? He might be in a couple just background gimmicky scenes at the beginning, yeah. But I can't remember an instance where he's in the movie past Chamber of Secrets.
You might be right.
Okay, so moving on from one famous Gryffindor to more, I'm going to talk about some of the most important Gryffindors in this series. So I'm going to kind of not talk about a lot of the ones that were during Harry's time at Hogwarts, just because we all know them and we'll probably have episodes exclusively on them. So basically, every important character in the Harry Potter series, every good guy in the Harry Potter series, 88% chance it's a Gryffindor.
88%?
88, specifically 88.2.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, so I mean that includes Dumbledore, the trio, basically all of Harry's friends, the Marauders, all the Weasleys, Harry's whole family, the Potters. But I am going to talk a little bit about Peter Pettigrew just because I think we are probably going to have an episode exclusively on him, so I won't talk about this much, but I really don't understand how he got put in Gryffindor. And a lot of people make the argument for how he died. It was brave. He did the noble thing, but I don't think that one noble act makes up for a lifetime of being a rat. And I think I use that same argument when I justify why I don't like Snape, but anyways.
I think Pettigrew, I take issue with his assignment to Gryffindor. I kind of like that he's in Gryffindor, though, because we do have someone that isn't a good guy that's in Gryffindor. But yeah. I also see a little bit of his qualities. So, I mean, the fact that he did seek out Voldemort, going to Voldemort was not a cowardly thing to do. It was pretty brave. He could have been killed on the spot because before he even was able to reveal.
You could make the argument for both, but you could make the argument that he's being a coward and like shirking his duties and turning his back on his friends. But yeah, I don't believe that it was easy to like go up to Voldemort.
Yeah, it was cowardly, but also
I get what you're saying.
At the same time. And also I think a lot of people make the argument that his whole relationship with Voldemort and stuff is because he's attracted to power and he latches onto people of power, which they say is ambition. That's a Slytherin trait. He should be in Slytherin. But I don't really see it as ambition because he doesn't want to go. He's not attracted to people of power because he wants to be powerful as well. He just wants to be protected, I think. I think he doesn't do everything he does out of ambition. He's not trying to become one of the most powerful people. He just doesn't want to be, he doesn't want to be on the losing side, which is then really cowardly. But it doesn't, I don't think that it's in support of Slytherin either, being his house.
Yeah, no, I get that. I think that we should probably do an episode on him because I want to break down that character and see if we can come up with any better reasons. So then I'm going to look past Harry's story to kind of, I think I have only a couple here listed, but so Sir Cadogan, I pronounce it Sir Cadogan. I've heard other people pronounce it different ways. That's how Jim Dale pronounces it in the audiobooks, and so I always side with Jim Dale. Yes, I say Canut. Sue me. So Sir Cadogan was a knight of the Round Table during the time of King Arthur, I believe. And then his kind of importance in the series comes about in Prisoner of Azkaban when he takes over being the guard of the Gryffindor common room from the Fat Lady after she is afraid because Sirius breaks or tries to break into the common room and she doesn't want to do it anymore. Another famous Gryffindor is Fleamont Potter, who is Harry's grandfather. He is the inventor of Sleek Easy's hair potion, and this was in 1926, and then he died later in 1979 of dragon pox. So that's like not that When was Harry, what year was Harry born? Ron was born in what, 1981? Wow, so he just missed his grandfather, and so James doesn't live that much longer than his father does.
He only, maybe Harry was born in 80, and I think that they die in Halloween of 81. So James and Lily outlive Fleamont by 2 years.
Yeah, wow. Because he was also older. James's parents were older. So.
Right, yeah.
I mean, older in the Wizarding world is probably relative, but yeah. That's just interesting. I never really thought about that before. And then another famous Gryffindor that I'm going to talk about quite a bit, actually, is Celestina Warbeck, who is the popular singer of, who is a popular singer in the Wizarding world. So I found all this information on Pottermore because J.K. Rowling actually has a writing on her, and I found that she's a Gryffindor, I believe, on the Wikia. Or on the wiki, so if you want to dispute that, take it up with them. So her popular songs include Cauldron Full of Hot Strong Love and You Charmed the Heart Right Out of Me. And I believe we hear a little bit of her songs in Half-Blood Prince.
Yeah, it's when they're
When they're at the Weasleys, because Mrs. Weasley loves Miss Warbeck.
And Fleur hates her.
Yeah, and Fleur is just roasting her the entire time. Gotta love her sometimes. So then I'm going to talk a little bit about the writing that J.K. has on her. So her mother was a failed Muggle actress who was not pleased when she found out that there was no art school or singing school or stage school for wizards. So she ended up bombarding the school with letters about starting a choir, theater club, or dance club so her daughter could have the proper outlet to show off her talents. Miss Warbeck's concerts are apparently legendary. A couple funny tidbits in the writing about her concerts are that three devoted fans were involved in a nasty three-way broom pileup over Liverpool when they were trying to get to the last night of her flighty Aphrodite tour. So I think that's super funny that J.K. puts that in there. I've never thought about wizarding crashes on brooms before, and I just think that's super interesting because we'd never heard of anything like that before. We don't really hear about wizards using brooms to get around in their daily life.
Right, and there's so much space in the air. How did they run into each other?
Yeah, there must have been just a huge swarm of people getting to this concert for this to happen. And then there also is a little bit of information about her ticket prices. Apparently, they're sold on the black market quite frequently at grossly inflated prices. And it's actually kind of sad because this is why Molly has never been able to see Celestina perform in person, because the tickets have always been too expensive. So that actually makes me kind of sad, and I hope that the money from Fred and George's joke shop or something, they bought her a ticket to see her, because she's her number one fan. And then later on in the writing, it talks about how she does participate in some philanthropy. She has raised funds for St. Mungo's in the past, and she has also recorded Puddlemere United's anthem, which is like, beat back those bludgers, boys. I believe that you can hear that at the Wizarding World in Orlando. And she's also been very vocal in her support of wizards having the right to celebrate Halloween, which has been in opposition to some of the previous ministers of magic. She doesn't really go into why that is, probably just because she's a show woman and she wants to party and dress up and have a good time. But I think that was really, I thought that was really interesting too, because in that tidbit you get quite a bit of information. You get that ministers of magic have been opposed to Halloween celebrations in the past. I wonder how wizards celebrate Halloween, because I know at Hogwarts they have the feast, but how wizards at home or not in school celebrate Halloween, that'd be interesting to hear about. And I'm not sure if that information is out there or not. And then her personal life has been featured in the Daily Prophet. In the past, her first marriage was to a backup dancer that only lasted a year. And then she married her manager and had a son with him. And then she left him for a composer, Irving Warble, 10 years later. It doesn't say if she's married to Mr. Warble, but so she's had at least two husbands. And then there's a little bit at the end, which I thought was super interesting. So JK has said that Celestine is actually one of her favorite, she calls it, offstage characters, so kind of background characters. She doesn't really contribute to the plot at all. She's just an extra in there, thrown in for entertainment, basically. Celestina has been a part of the Potter world since the beginning. She was only able to fit her in later on in the series, but ever since the first iterations of the Harry Potter series, Celestina was a character. She imagines her to resemble Shirley Bassey, which I don't know who that is, but probably some old Hollywood singer. And she got the name from a friend that she worked with years ago. And there's a quote that says, Celestina was simply begging to be scooped up and attached to a glamorous witch, which I love that. I think that's so cool.
That's a great name.
Yeah, and then moving on from Celestina, I have one more tidbit about famous Gryffindors. So the Queen, J.K. Rowling herself, was sorted into Gryffindor on Pottermore, which I don't really know much about her as a person, and I don't know if I could back that up, but I thought that was interesting.
I think the little that I do know about J.K. does support the Gryffindor thing. Like, I know that she did battle depression a lot, and I think she was a single mother while she was writing the books, and just has had a lot of hardship in her life, and I think faced it with bravery. So I like that for her.
Yeah, I like that too. And I know that she's super involved in charity and philanthropy too, which I think you could make an argument that shows Gryffindor-like qualities as well.
Definitely. All right, so the Gryffindor Common Room, the hub of Gryffindor House. It's at the top of Gryffindor Tower, and of course protected by the portrait of the Fat Lady, who requires a password before she opens. And so we hear about Gryffindor Common Room so much throughout the series, so I'm not going to go into all the details. It's always a place where Harry, Ron, and Hermione are hanging out. The twins are often up to no good. I just always love the scenes in Gryffindor Common Room. They feel so cozy and usually happy, and, you know, good things are happening. But the first description of Gryffindor Common Room I am going to read. So this is, of course, when Harry first gets to Hogwarts after the initial feast. All right, so it says, "Password," she said. "Caput Draconis," said Percy, and the portrait swung forward to reveal a round hole in the wall. They all scrambled through it, Neville needed a leg up, and found themselves in the Gryffindor Common Room, a cozy round room full of squashy armchairs. Percy directed the girls through one door to their dormitory, and the boys through another. At the top of a spiral staircase, they were obviously in one of the towers, they found their beds at last. 5 four-posters hung with deep red velvet curtains. Their trunks had already been brought up. Too tired to talk much, they pulled on their pajamas and fell into bed.
I think that something that quote made me think about is when it says Neville needed a leg up. And they talk about later in The Half-Blood Prince when Ginny and Dean are fighting, the straw that broke the camel's back in their relationship is Dean helping her through the portrait. So do they have to crawl through a tiny hole behind it, or do they just have to step up? I don't understand, because I feel like they hint at stuff throughout this series. It seems more difficult than just stepping up a step, you know?
Right. I think I always imagined it. It's not, they don't get down on their knees and crawl. Obviously, it's up higher, but it's not, they can't just walk through. I think they have to kind of crouch to go through it, which is kind of funny, because you have 11-year-olds going through it, so Neville obviously needs help. And then you have 17-year-olds going through it, so it needs to be big enough for the full-grown human. It's kind of funny.
Yeah, it's interesting. So then I'm going to talk a little bit about Gryffindor's relationship with other houses. I'm not going to go super in-depth on any of them, but just kind of an overview. So with Ravenclaw, in my opinion, I think that Gryffindor and Ravenclaw are kind of the two most opposite houses, or at least Gryffindor is the most opposite from Ravenclaw as opposed to Hufflepuff and Slytherin, which I think this is pretty interesting, because both for McGonagall and Hermione, there was a lot, it took the Sorting Hat a really long time to decide between those two houses, and they obviously both end up being Gryffindors, but McGonagall was a Hatstall, an official Hatstall, and she took 5.5 minutes to be sorted, and I believe Hermione was just verging on being an official Hatstall.
I just want to point out that I, being a Ravenclaw, This makes me really unique and kind of like Hermione and McGonagall as well.
Yeah. And so then I'm going to talk about some of the reasons why I think that they're opposites. And I think the main one is Gryffindors think with their heart as one of their defining traits. And Ravenclaws think with their head as one of their defining traits. So I believe that both of those are very important aspects to each house. And I think that makes them very different. Making the decision with your heart and your head normally ends up with opposite answers. For example, when I was deciding between colleges, one, I always felt my heart. I wanted to go there. But the other one made more sense. It was my brain was telling me to go to one college and my heart was telling me to go to another one. So they're you get two completely different outcomes if you think with your brain as opposed to your heart. If anybody's wondering, I went with my heart on that decision. And I believe it was the right one. And then the two houses actually do have pretty good relations. You can see that, especially in Luna and Cho. Especially with Luna, we talked about in our Luna episode how she adopts Gryffindor kind of as her second house, cheering for them in Quidditch when they're not playing Ravenclaw with her headdress. And then Gryffindor's relationship with Hufflepuff, they mostly get along with each other. I think that there are some key exceptions, and both kind of are when Hufflepuffs are tightening up. They defend their own. They show their loyalty. And the first is in Chamber, when they think that Harry is the heir of Slytherin, is the one who petrified Justin Finch-Fletchley, who is a Hufflepuff. And then in the Goblet of Fire, when they believe that Harry is kind of taking away the glory that they're due from Cedric being the Hogwarts champion.
And then also this dynamic makes me think of, is it Ernie McMillan? Who, at first, Harry, Ron, and Hermione, they think he's kind of annoying, and then he joins DA, and they get along with him. But Harry always kind of thinks he's a little bit pompous and annoying.
Yeah.
And stuff. So they can get along well enough, but they're not ever going to be close, because I think the Gryffindors kind of look down on the Hufflepuffs, or just they're not. I don't think Harry, Ron, and Hermione really want to spend that much time with Ernie.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think that I'm not backing down off my claim that Ravenclaws and Gryffindors are the most opposite, but I definitely think that Hufflepuffs probably get along with Gryffindors the least, and that's saying something because I feel like Hufflepuff gets along with everybody to some respect, but maybe Gryffindor the least.
Also, though, Hannah Abbott and Neville do get married. So there's
Neville's a little bit of a Griffin Puff, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
He was almost a Hatzel. I mean, that was mainly because he believed he should be in Hufflepuff. He didn't think he was worthy of being a Gryffindor, but. And then also with Hufflepuffs, again, this is probably just me being a Hufflepuff and a little bit of my own bias coming in, but I think that Hufflepuffs are a little bit resentful of all the attention that Gryffindors get. I think that Gryffindors overall, even if you remove yourself from the Harry Potter series, if you think about the Wizarding World, I think Gryffindors are lauded a little bit more than the other three houses. I think that's kind of just their basic reputation. You know, Slytherins are the bad guys, Hufflepuff are the duffers, Gryffindor are the cool people, and Ravenclaw is the smart people. So I think that Hufflepuffs do kind of resent that a little bit. I don't think that they show it much or like to think that they actually think that, but I think they do, or at least this Hufflepuff does. And then with Slytherin, they have very bad relations. They basically hate each other, at least throughout Harry's time, and I think that could be said for almost any time at Hogwarts, because we also see that in the Marauder's time. And I think that a lot of people say that this goes back to the founders falling out. Gryffindor and Slytherin were BFFs, and then they had a big fight, and then they were no longer friends, and Slytherin hit a snake in the school, as one does. But I think that Gryffindors and Slytherins are actually pretty similar, and I think a lot of people agree with me on this. I was browsing the interweb, and I think that this is a pretty commonly held belief. So they're both pretty opinionated, vengeful, and goal-oriented. They're both self-reliant and prideful. I think sometimes that can come off as conceited in one house as opposed to the other, but they're essentially the same. They're both pretty smart. They're both brave. Resourceful is a word that is used exclusively for Slytherins, but I think you could extend that to Gryffindors. I think Harry's pretty resourceful. I think he thinks on his feet, works with what he has. And I think that they're both a little bit quick-tempered. But I think the main difference is how they carry out those actions. Gryffindors base their actions on what is right, and Slytherins base their actions on what they think is right. I do think that those are two different things. I think a way to expand on that would be to say that Gryffindor will make the hard choice, but Slytherin will always choose themselves. That kind of thing. And I'm not saying that one is better than the other. I just think that they have very similar traits, but then how they carry out their actions and those traits is pretty different.
Yeah, I was just going to back you up by saying that I think the difference between those two things is that Gryffindors think about what is right for everyone. They see more of the big picture, whereas Slytherins, it's what's right for them and their family or the people that they feel close to. All right, so now I think we're going to go into the Quidditch team, Gryffindor House Quidditch team, and I have a lot of written down on this, but it is barely anything in comparison to all of the information available on the lexicon. There's so much there, and if you're ever complaining about how JK doesn't write enough about Quidditch, which I complain about a lot, I love the Quidditch scenes, and then she kind of drops them out because she doesn't like them. There's a whole bunch of information on the lexicon, so you should go check that out. So anyway, Gryffindor Quidditch team, we know they wear their scarlet-red robes. They're traditionally a pretty strong team. However, they lost the cup to Slytherin 7 years straight, from 1985 to 1991. So going back to that rivalry there. So just a little timeline, the recent history of the team. So in the 1970s, we know James Potter's team won the cup at least once.
I just want to interject and say that James is a chaser, not a seeker,
yes.
Which I have had wrong for basically until last year. I blame the scene in Order of the Phoenix. Yes, when Harry goes back and, like, he's playing with a snitch. Like, come on.
Yeah.
You should be playing with a... Whatever, it's fine.
All right. But. So, yes, in the 1970s, when James was a chaser, they won the cup at least once. We don't know how many times. And then from 85 to 91, this was when Charlie Weasley was on the team, and Gryffindor loses the cup to Slytherin 7 years straight during Charlie's time, which... It's interesting because we always hear about how great of a seeker Charlie was, and he never was able to lead his team to the house Quidditch Cup. So I don't know. And then 91 to 92 school year is when Harry joins, and Slytherin wins the cup again. 92 to 93, the cup was canceled because all of the students were getting petrified due to the Chamber of Secrets being opened. Enemies of the air, beware. Slytherin probably would have won that year because they weren't really affected by it.
They were the only people that weren't dropping like flies.
93 to 94, this is when Gryffindor wins the cup. So this is in Harry's third year. That was pretty exciting. 94 to 95 was the Triwizard Tournament. So the cup was canceled. And then 95 to 96, Gryffindor wins the cup again. But after the first game, Fred, George, and Harry are all banned. And I think it was because they fought Malfoy after. Malfoy was taunting. It was after the game. Harry gets the snitch right just ahead of Malfoy. And Malfoy starts talking shit about the Weasleys.
Yes. And Mrs. Weasley. But brings up Harry's mom, too,
yeah.
I think. Doesn't she? I feel like he mentioned something about Lily, too.
Yeah, some classic trash talk there. But then I think what happens is they're being held back, and then for some reason, Fred and George and Harry all get through. Everyone else is holding them back.
Well, only one of the twins gets through. I don't remember which one, but only one of them gets through. But then Umbridge is like, well, you guys are twins.
Yes.
You would have, she was like, the other one would have fought if he wasn't being held back. So I'm just going to ban him too.
Right. Right. Because Harry was holding back either Fred or George. And then the three girls were holding back the other twin. And then Malfoy says something that pisses Harry off too. So he lets go and him and one of the twins go beat Malfoy up. And then the other twin remains held back. So then anyway, after that whole debacle, Ron and Ginny join the team for the first time. Ginny plays Seeker. Takes Harry's role, and there's a few other people that join that aren't very good, but nevertheless, Gryffindor still wins the cup. And then 96 to 97, during Half-Blood Prince, Harry's captain, and Gryffindor wins the cup again. All right, so some players on this team that we know and, for the most part, love, I would say. We got Harry, of course, he was the Seeker, and then the captain in his sixth year. And he was the youngest house player in a century. And then taking after his father, James, in Quidditch. But James was a chaser in the 1970s. So then we know about McGonagall. She was a Quidditch player. I think her position is not actually mentioned, but for some reason I always thought she was a chaser. We don't know.
I will back you up on that. I think so. I think that as well.
And then I have a little note here. Who the fuck knows when at this point? Because Crimes of Grindelwald
is fucking everything up.
But anyway, during her time, McGonagall got a concussion and broke her ribs due to a foul committed against her in the match for Slytherin that would have decided the cup winner. It sounds like it was a dirty foul, and this is why she's always so passionate about Quidditch and always wants Gryffindor to win, and she's so happy when they win the cup. So then Katie Bell, classic.
Shout out Katie.
Yeah, shout out to Katie. She was a chaser. And we know that she missed matches in her seventh year, which was Harry's sixth year, due to the cursed necklace that freaking Draco Malfoy gave her, trying to get it to Dumbledore. And then we got Angelina Johnson, who was a chaser as well, and a captain during Harry's fifth year. She was kind of crazy when she was a captain. So then we have Cormac McLaggen, who is a keeper. We do not love him. He does not fall into the no and love category.
Okay, I will say that in the movies, he's hot.
Yeah. Like, oh, yeah.
Prime.
Of course, but he sucks.
Yeah, he's so annoying, but he's so cute.
So, yeah, he tries out for the keeper at the beginning of Half-Blood Prince, and Hermione confronts him, so Ron wins the tryout. But he does play one match after Ron gets poisoned. And that doesn't go well. He tries to take over the team. He knocks Harry out with a bludger. It's a mess. And then we have Alicia Spinnett, who's also a chaser. Just kind of in that trio I always think of Angelina, Alicia, and Katie.
Shout out, girls. I love that. I mean, it's seven players, so the balance could never be truly equal, but it's 3-4. That's a pretty good balance, because Cho was the only female on the Ravenclaw team when she played Harry, I believe.
Right, and I don't think that Slytherin has any.
At least in the movies, they don't. Movies. Yeah. I don't remember ever curing a roster for the Slytherin. Quidditch team. I'm sure it's out there, though.
Yeah. All right. And then we have Oliver Wood, who was keeper, and he was also captain when Harry joined. So that means he was captain, or I think that was his fifth year, maybe, but he was captain as a fourth year before that, which is wild. I didn't know this. He was captain while Charlie was still on the team. This is according to the lexicon. So I don't know what their sources are, but maybe, and I know Charlie was captain, but then maybe he didn't want to be captain his seventh year and Oliver took over. I don't know. He is really good at Quidditch. We know that he teaches Harry how to play, and he played for Puddlemere United's reserve team. Shout out back to Celestina Warbeck and her Puddlemere United anthem.
Do we ever find out whether he plays for not the reserve team? Do we ever find out what happens afterwards?
I don't think we do.
Do he ever makes it?
I don't know. So then, if you've noticed that I've been leaving out a lot of Quidditch players, we have the entire Weasley family. or almost entire. So Charlie was the seeker and the captain. Like I said, he's regarded as a legend. Fred and George were beaters together. They were on the team 1 year before Harry was, and then they were also banned in the Order of the Phoenix with Harry. Ginny is one of the best Weasley. I think she's the best Weasley Quidditch player. She was a seeker and a chaser. She played seeker while Harry was banned, but then she became a chaser. She's just a total badass. She played pro later on for the Holyhead Harpies, which is the only all-female team. And I just really like this instance in Order where Fred says he doesn't know how she got so good because they never used to let her play. And then Hermione tells him and George and Harry, I think, that Ginny has been stealing the boys' brooms since age 6 to go play when they weren't using their brooms.
Okay, going back to my question about Oliver, I mean this in no disrespect to Ginny, but I think that Oliver was probably on par level with Ginny's abilities as a Quidditch player. So if Ginny could make it pro, I feel like Oliver should have. He was a great keeper.
Yeah, but I think also the fact that he was a keeper, it's tougher to make it pro because there's only one keeper per team, whereas Ginny being a chaser, there's three per team.
Yeah, that is true, too. I just think that's interesting. I really hope he made it pro. He was so passionate about Quidditch. There's nobody that's more passionate about it than Oliver Wood. Also, he's hot in the movies, too. Side note.
Katie has a type.
Quidditch players.
So then the last two Weasleys I have listed here, we got Ron, his little stint as keeper. He's not really ever very consistent or confident, but he does improve, I guess. I don't know. It's always kind of painful to watch him play. And then one of the good things we learned from Cursed Child is that Rose Granger Weasley is a badass Quidditch player. She's a chaser, which I think I like that because maybe she got that from her aunt.
Yeah, probably. I mean, it definitely wasn't from her mom. Okay, so we're going to start to close out the episode. We're going to talk about our favorite and least favorite Gryffindor characters. So my favorite Gryffindor is Ginny. I talked about how she was one of my favorite characters in our first episode, but so I'm not going to go too much in detail about that, but I just love her. I have a special place in my heart for Ginny, and I always will.
Yeah, my favorite is Hermione. She's also one of my favorites throughout the series. And, I don't know, I just think she's the best.
So I have on here that my least favorite Gryffindor is actually Ron. I'm really having regrets, and I've been trying to find somebody to replace him with for, like, the past week. But I haven't been able to, so that's why I kept it there. Ron, sometimes, I will put that disclaimer there, during the Goblet of Fire, on the hunt for Horcruxes, when he throws a hissy fit and leaves, when he's dating Lavender, after he wins the cup, he becomes super conceited and gross. So Ron, sometimes, I think. And then also, obviously, Peter Pettigrew. But I feel like that's a cop-out answer, because, obviously...
Right. My least favorite Gryffindor I listed as Wormtail because he's the worst. But during Harry's time, I was thinking about this and I realized how much Lavender Brown pisses me off. She's so annoying. And so I was doing a little research on it and I found this thing on Pottermore. It's an article that it's titled Exploring Lavender Brown's Unexpected Effect on Hermione. And it's just all of the instances where Hermione gets so annoyed with Lavender Brown, and it's the only time that Hermione really gets thrown off. The opening paragraph is, Hermione Granger was cool as a cucumber. She was a witch who prided herself on being logical. She was defender of the underdog, loyal to a fault, and her lack of giggling and gossipiness meant she didn't fall into any teenage girl cliches. She wasn't mean, she didn't talk behind her friends' backs, and she didn't lust dreamily after every boy she saw. Step forward, Lavender Brown. And that's a super cool article. If you get the chance to look at it, definitely go read through it. It's kind of funny. And it also makes me feel bad for Hermione that she had to live with this in the same room as this girl for 6 years. That is a long time.
I feel like that's something that we collectively, just as Potter fans, forget that she lived with Pavarti, Lavender. I feel like there was another one that was a part of that clique. I can't remember.
I feel like we never really hear fully about the Gryffindor girls.
Yeah, who are the other Gryffindors? I don't even know the other Gryffindors. Wow, that's really bad. Anyways, I feel like we just forget that she's probably better friends with them. Maybe, I feel like she probably has an on-again, off-again friendship with Lavender. One of those people, because how can you live with somebody for that many times and at least not be, like, comfortable around them and, like, you know what I mean?
She really gets under her skin, though.
Yeah, I feel like they are on again. I think they have a little bit of an on again, off again friendship, though. I think that Lavender really does piss Hermione off, but at the end of the day, Hermione's not gonna survive living with somebody she hates 24. You know what I mean? It's not plausible. Mm-hmm. But I think we forget that she's probably better friends with those girls than we think she is, because she's always with Ron and Harry. But every time she's not, she's probably with them.
It's a shame she couldn't just live with Ginny.
True.
Although we never even really hear about
who are the other Gryffindor girls in Ginny's hair.
We never hear about them.
Okay. I need a Hogwarts roster. That's the next thing I need JK to come out with, is just school records. Just give them to me.
The book. That.
Yes, the book. The, like, book of admittance or something. Yeah. Is that what it's called? Okay, and as we do every episode, we're going to close out with our pop quiz. Ding, 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 ding. We need a sound effect. So this time our question is, would you rather fight a basilisk or a Bellatrix?
A Bellatrix.
Bellatrix.
I would most certainly rather fight Bellatrix, because I hate snakes, and the basilisk is fucking huge. It's terrifying. It's like the worst kind of snake. So I would definitely rather fight Bellatrix, even though she's terrible. I would have all the more joy after I defeated her.
That's true. I'm going to make the case for Basilisk just to spice this up a little bit. So Bellatrix takes many full-grown wizards to defeat. I mean, Molly eventually does it, but before that, I think she's dueling, like, Ginny and two other people, and that's why Molly steps in. The Basilisk took 12-year-old Harry, or 13-year-old Harry, or however, 12-year-old Harry to defeat. I mean, he did have a little assist from Fox, but I think the Basilisk might be just easier to defeat. I mean, once you take its eyes out, I mean, it just got stabbed.
That's true.
I don't know. I think it might be easier than Bellatrix.
Okay, so just another reminder, go subscribe to us, Wizard Studies on Apple Podcasts. Download and listen to our episodes. They're released every other Tuesday, so check in for those.
And then you can find us on Facebook and Instagram as Wizard Study Podcast.
And as always, thank you so much for listening. Remember, just do your best. We'll do the rest.
And learn until our brains all rot.